For just an instant, when the statue stood still, the wizards could see Martin, suspended inside the statue's massive torso. It silently towered over the wizards as they sat, gaping in their seats. The huge staff it held level above its head was also constructed of imp boxes. The head of Santo looked large enough that a grown man could hide in it. Another brief round of applause started, but stopped dead when the statue raised its head. With a strange combination of ponderousness and speed, the statue's left hand pushed the staff, which spun like a helicopter blade, pivoting on the blindingly fast brick fingers of the statue's right hand. The hall filled with a deafening roar of wind until the statue's right arm came down to the statue's side, stopping the staff's spinning and slamming its base into the floor with a sound like a sonic boom. The statue looked straight ahead and let go of the staff, which stood balanced for a moment, then it collapsed into a pile of boxes, which spread into a lumpy rectangle at the statue of Martin's feet. The rectangle sharpened and solidified into the unmistakable shape of an immense sheet of corrugated cardboard and a massive dual-cassette boombox with four huge speakers. The statue looked down at the table of speechless wizards and jerked its chin upward sharply as if to say, "What's up?" The giant statue bent sideways at the waist. With a massive finger, it hit a button on the top of the boombox. The great hall was filled with the familiar hiss of a cassette player until the inevitable finally happened. The boombox played Herbie Hancock's Rocket. As loud as the giant boombox was, it was nearly drowned out by cheering and laughing as the statue started to do the robot. Once it had demonstrated its mastery of robotics, the statue dove forward, did a serviceable version of the worm, then hoisted itself into a headstand and swung its legs around wildly for a moment before doing a head spin. The head spin transitioned seamlessly into a backspin, which ended with the statue lying on its side on the cardboard. It was facing the wizards, its head supported by its arm, and its upper leg bent at the knee in a posture of simulated relaxation. With its free arm, the robot formed a gun with its thumb and forefinger, which it aimed at the table of wizards. As Herbie Hancock hit a large downbeat on the drums, the statue shot the finger gun, and in an instant, the statue, the boombox, and the cardboard all collapsed into splinters that fell to the ground and disappeared. All of the wizards were applauding and cheering, except one. The cheering only got louder when they realized that the wizard who wasn't applauding was Martin, who had been standing next to Jimmy since the moment the statue started dancing. The rest of the night was a blur of drinking and laughing. The only serious moment occurred when Jimmy pulled him aside and asked him about his plans.
"I haven't made any beyond trying to pass the trials tomorrow," Martin said.
"Look, I know you and Philip are friends," Jimmy said. "And I know that Philip and I aren't, but if you don't have anything to do in Lead Church, I hope you'll consider coming here to Camelot. I could use a man like you."
Martin looked at Jimmy, then looked around at the opulent palace Jimmy had essentially created through sheer force of will.
"What on earth would you possibly need me for, Jimmy?"
Jimmy patted him on the back.
"In theory, no one wizard is more powerful than any other. But you'll learn that just because the shell gives everyone else the same powers you have, doesn't mean that they can do the same things you can do. You have something very rare, Martin. Showmanship. You know what most of these guys' salutations are? They fly and they glow and they shoot energy beams. If I'm lucky, they swing their staff around a bit while they do it."
Martin remembered Philip's display the night they met. Jimmy had just described it pretty well.
"What you did tonight was the first really original thing I've seen in a very long time. None of these guys could have done it. They don't have flair like you do."
"Gary has flair," Martin said.
"Yes," Jimmy admitted, "but he has no taste. He's all hellfire and bat wings. It's impressive, but nothing I can use." "I can use you, Martin. Think about it. You don't have to decide tonight, but when you get bored in Lead Church, and you will, you can always come here and help me make the world better."
Sometime around 1:30 in the morning, Martin learned the best thing about wizard parties, which is that because wizards can teleport, they can sleep in their own beds no matter how drunk they get or how far away the party was.
Unfortunately, they still were susceptible to hangovers. And Martin woke up with the worst one of his life. The swaying of his hammock made him feel vaguely ill. The light coming in the windows made his brain feel as if it was on fire. The slightest noise was agony. For a moment, while he was still only half awake, he thought he heard a very distant, hollow noise that sounded almost like growling, which was a new one, but he figured it was the blood rushing through the veins in his ears. He carefully dismounted his hammock. He groaned lightly as his feet took over the task of supporting his weight. The groan was barely a whisper, but it was enough to cause Philip to gasp,
"Keep down the racket!"
Then Philip winced at the toll his own voice had taken on his head. Martin attempted to say he was sorry silently by squinting at Philip and waving his arms vaguely, and then he shuffled into the bathroom to go deface Jimmy's statue. Over the next hour, the two men moped and groaned their way back into the world of the living. The quality of life in medieval England had improved drastically since Martin learned to pull black coffee, real food, and over-the-counter pain medications out of his hat. Of course, all of the food items he could access were gifted to him by Philip. He wouldn't be able to set up macros to retrieve his own favorite items until he had unlimited shell access and the ability to come and go to the future without the imminent threat of arrest. He'd figure out how to deal with the feds later. Today, his only priority was to pass the trials. He'd have felt a lot better if he knew what the trials were, but nobody had been willing to tell him anything. Martin spent the morning going over vocab, quizzing himself on technique, and generally making himself more nervous. Philip spent the morning reading a dog-eared paperback of Ender's Game that he'd borrowed from Jeff. After a couple of hours of this, Philip's hut was filled with a warbling chime sound that Martin had anticipated and dreaded in equal measure. Philip smiled at Martin and said,
"Well, Martin, that's the call. You ready?"
"I really don't think so," Martin answered.
"Good."
Philip raised his right arm and held his hand as if he were palming a softball. The chiming sound died, and the glowing blue image of a calligraphic letter M appeared in Philip's hand.
"The hour is nigh," Jimmy's voice bellowed. "Is the initiate ready to face the trials?"
"Yep,"
Philip said with aggressive informality.
"Excellent! Bring him forth to the great hall of the Castle Camelot to be tested and judged."
"Uh-huh.
Will do," Philip replied.
The uppercase M in Philip's hand hovered there silently for a long moment, then disappeared. "Does he do everything in the Great Hall?" Martin asked.
"Wouldn't you?"
Philip stood up, smoothing out his robe.
"Well," he said, "I guess it's about that time. Do you have to use the bathroom before we go?"
"No," Martin said.
"You?"
"No," Philip said. "Let's just get this done."
Martin hesitated. Phil, I just want to say, no matter how this ends up, I really appreciate everything you've done for me." Philip put a comforting hand on Martin's shoulder.
"You're welcome, Martin. And don't worry, you're going to do fine."
Martin smirked. "I know, because if I don't, you'll send me to prison naked." Philip looked wounded.
"I wasn't going to say that, Marty."
"Oh, I'm sorry."
"But it's true. We'll totally do that to you. Transporto rondo tableau!"
In an instant, they were standing in the center of the black granite disc that marked the center of the great hall of the Castle Camelot. The disc was raised as it was when being used as the round table, but the chairs remained recessed into the floor, giving the overall effect that Martin and Philip were standing on a raised pedestal for examination. The hall was dim, despite the massive windows that lined its sides. Martin saw that there were huge curtains drawn over the windows, blocking most of the light. All of the wizards he had met, dined with, and entertained, with his avatars breakdancing the night before, were there, arranged in a curved row, facing the platform where he and Philip stood. As his eyes adjusted, Martin could see that one of the wizards on the end seemed to be holding some rope. At the middle of the line, one wizard stood taller than the rest because he was hovering 5 inches above the floor.
"Who comes to face the trials?"
the hovering wizard asked.
With all due respect, Philip said, you know exactly who it is, and I'd appreciate it if you didn't waste his time with your idiocy, Jimmy.
That wasn't very respectful,
Jimmy said.
No, but it's all the respect you're due. Now get on with it.
Martin recognized Jeff and Gary's laughs coming from the end of the line of wizards. Jimmy took a moment to compose himself, then continued.
Are his skills adequate to the challenges that await him?
You know they are, or I wouldn't have said he was ready, would I?
Philip answered.
All right, then. Philip, you've done your duty. Leave your apprentice to his fate.
Philip clambered down off of the platform and walked slowly to the end of the shadowy line of wizards. As he reached his spot, he said,
Hello, Gary, Jeff. You brought the extra scratchy rope, I see.
Muffled laughs and shushing followed.
Martin, do you feel ready to leave your life as an apprentice behind and take on the powers and responsibilities of a wizard?
Martin gave Jimmy a look that he hoped read as determination and said,
Yes.
A long moment passed. Nobody moved. Nobody spoke. If someone had told Martin that the birds outside had stopped flying in midair, he would not have doubted it. Finally, Jimmy said,
Okay.
Martin looked at all of the other wizards. They all looked at him. He looked back to Jimmy and said,
Good.
Jimmy replied,
Yes, good.
Martin looked at Philip, who held up his hands and mouthed the word, What?
They're messing with me, Martin thought. They're trying to put me off balance. Then when I'm vulnerable, the trials will begin.
He bent his knees, transferring his weight to the balls of his feet. He hunched his shoulders slightly, put his empty left hand out in front of him for balance, and held his staff slightly behind so he could whip it forward with force if need be. For another long moment, all was silent, and Martin was at the center of the universe, a coiled spring, ready for whatever happened next. Eventually, Martin realized that nothing was going to happen. He stood up straight again and asked,
Okay, what's going on?
When the wizards were done laughing, Jimmy explained,
It's over, Martin. You're in.
What? But the trials
were last night,
Jimmy said.
If you must call him that. Look, Martin, the point of the trials is to make sure that you know what you're doing and that you can be trusted. Philip has lived with you and trained you, and he says you're okay. We all met you last night, and you didn't set off anybody's warning bells, so you're in.
Martin sat down on the edge of the round table. He didn't know if he was more relieved or angry.
So it was all a lie?
No, Philip said as he walked to where Martin was sitting. It wasn't all a lie. It was mostly a lie. In a sense, the trials began when you and I met, and the final test was your macro last night. You got off to a rocky start, but you paid attention, you learned, and you took the whole thing seriously.
What if I hadn't? Martin asked. It's happened before. Philip told me about a trainee who failed a few years ago.
Mitchell, one of the three wizards from Paris, spoke up.
Yeah, I had an apprentice who seemed all right at first. Then I caught him practicing his powers on animals. Nasty business.
What did you do?
I called Jimmy,
Mitchell said,
and told him about it. He had me tell the guy that he was ready for the trials. We had a dinner just like last night, and he showed us his macro, which I'm not going to describe to you because there are some things you can't unhear. It's bad enough we had to see it. Ooh. Anyway, after that we were unanimous that he had to go. The next morning we told him he'd failed, and we used the shell to make it so that no integrated circuit would function within 10 feet of him.
That's how you keep him from using the file, Martin said. I'd wondered about that.
Yeah, unless he figures out how to access the file from an abacus, the world is safe. Then we send him back to his time.
Yeah, Martin said, waving his hand. Hog-tied and naked so the police would get him. Are you sure the police were looking for him?
Oh, yeah,
Mitchell said.
No question. Now, the fact is, the police are looking for almost all of us.
Many heads nodded. Gary said,
It turns out that bank fraud is surprisingly hard to get away with, even if you create the money out of thin air.
Jimmy nodded.
Not surprisingly, really. At the end of the day, all a bank really does is track money. It makes sense that they'd be pretty good at it.
By this time, all of the wizards had walked over near where Martin was sitting. Fun is fun, but they knew they had put Martin through the ringer, and they wanted to make sure he was all right. Partly because they'd all been there themselves, and partly because few things are more dangerous than a wizard bent on revenge.
So, Marty, Philip said, you haven't said yet if you'll join us.
Martin shook his head.
Are you kidding? Philip, how can you ask me that? Of course I'm going to join you, even if there wasn't unimaginable power in it for me. And even if the feds weren't waiting in my time to take me to jail, I'd stick around just to help do this to the next sap to come along.
That was when everyone knew that Martin was truly one of them. There were many handshakes and backslaps. Jimmy congratulated Martin, then excused himself and his assistant, Eddie, saying they had pressing business elsewhere. Gary made a pizza run, and the remaining wizards generally had a pleasant afternoon. They all found Martin to be a little quicker to laugh now that the pressure was off. Slowly, wizards started making their excuses and going back to their homes. Finally, it was just Martin, Philip, Gary, and Jeff left to clean up.
I wish Tyler were here,
Gary said.
He'd have enjoyed this, Philip agreed.
That, and he has all those paper towels in his apartment,
Gary said while attempting to scrape some melted cheese off of the granite table with the edge of a cardboard pizza box, leaving a smear of oil behind.
You could go to your time and get a roll, Jeff said.
Yes, but we both know that's not going to happen,
Gary said. He piled all of the pizza boxes on the stone floor, aimed his staff at them, and said,
Flammo, sir.
There was an intense gout of blue flames. The pizza boxes completely burned away in less than a second. With nothing left to feed them, the flames took on the shapes of demons and rose to the ceiling and dissipated. For just a moment, Martin could see that the spaces between the flames took the shape of a man waving his arms frantically as if in agony. When the flames were gone, Martin said,
That was a touch overdramatic.
Jeff smiled.
Like you should talk.
Jeff and Gary said goodbye and disappeared into thin air.
How do you think he made the areas between the flames look like a person?
Martin asked. Philip said.
I didn't even notice that.
There was nothing left for Martin and Philip to do but go home themselves. Home meaning Philip's home, which became all too obvious to Martin quite quickly. They rematerialized in Philip's hut, and Philip rubbed his hands together and said,
I expect you'll be anxious to get out on your own.
Martin didn't know how to react.
Philip, I hope I haven't done something to make you think I'm anxious to leave.
Oh, Marty,
Philip said in a chummy sort of way.
I didn't say think. I said expect. There's a difference. So, where will you go?
I guess I'll get a place of my own,
Martin sputtered.
Splendid idea! When?
I don't know, tomorrow morning?
Philip shook his head and put an arm around Martin's shoulders. He said,
Martin, don't stay here for me.
Martin clearly heard a comma that wasn't stated, but was there nonetheless. Martin, don't stay here. For me. Martin suddenly realized that Philip had shared his entire existence with Martin, and now he wanted it to himself again. Martin couldn't blame him.
It's a bit late to try to find a shack of my own, Martin said. But I bet Pete has a room at the Rotted Stump he'd rent me until I find a place.
I bet he does. You might even be able to pay him in cling film. I'll tell you what, you go get a room, and then I'll help you move your things.
All I have is my laptop.
I'll help you move your thing.
Martin had set a teleportation waypoint for the Rotted Stump. He suspected Pete, Gert, and the others would be pleasant company if he stopped trying to impress them all the time, a quality he now realized that they shared with pretty much all of humanity. He uttered some Esperanto and appeared outside the Rotted Stump. A friendly conversation and a small transaction later, he was the temporary owner of a room with a bed in it. When he reappeared at the hut, Philip was waiting. Martin grabbed his laptop. Philip handed him his bundle of street clothes, wrapped in his old Hogwarts robe. Martin had nearly forgotten them, but realized immediately that he'd want them if he ever went back to his own time. Neither of them were particularly emotional guys, so their goodbye couldn't help but be awkward. A poorly worded thank you was followed by an inelegant you're welcome, and punctuated with a stiff, uncertain hug. When the hug finally ended, Philip said,
I'm happy to have you as a friend, Martin, and even happier to lose you as a roommate.
What would have been a cutting remark just 15 minutes before made them both laugh now. Then Martin teleported to his room on the second floor of the rotted stump, and he was on his own. That night, Martin lay in bed and considered his next move. He could do anything he wanted. He just had to figure out what he wanted. He didn't know what he wanted to do with his life in the long term, but that could wait. Near term was all he needed to worry about tonight. The noise from the tavern coming up through the floorboards made it clear that his first order of business would be getting a place of his own. His first impulse was to stay in Ledchurch. All of his friends were here, and there was close proximity to Gwen. Then again, Ledchurch was a pretty small place, and as he said, all of his friends were here. It was a pretty high wizard saturation for such a small town. Then it struck him that he didn't actually know where Gary's cave was. He'd assumed it was close, but he never asked. For all he knew, the cave was clear up in Scotland. For the first time, it really struck home with Martin that, thanks to teleportation, the entire world was really just down the hall. He could literally set up shop anywhere, and it would make no difference. Martin thought about all he knew of this version of medieval England, and realized that the most interesting place he knew of was Camelot. Martin was a city boy, and Camelot was where the action was. He didn't have to worry about Jimmy getting angry because Martin was moving in on his turf because Jimmy had invited him. He didn't know how Philip would react, but it wasn't like he was siding with Jimmy. He was just moving to the capital to see things for himself. The next morning, Martin used the handphone spell to call Jimmy. He told the glowing M in his palm that he was going to stay in Camelot for a while. It took some effort not to call it London, to see if he liked it. Jimmy was delighted, and said that he'd have Eddie find a couple of prospective places to look at. The following day, Eddie had 3 places to show Martin. Eddie explained the various features of the buildings, resplendent in his red silk robe with gold-embroidered dragons, as he showed the sizes of the rooms and the proximity to various shops and inns. Martin amused himself with the notion that it was like having Ming the Merciless as a realtor. He mentioned this to Eddie. Eddie laughed, then pointed out in his thick New Jersey accent that Martin was wearing a silver robe and carrying a stick with a luchador head on it. Martin thought, it's amazing how quickly we get used to the weirdness when it's our own weirdness. He settled on a building in a bustling area on the east side of town. It had been used mainly for storage. It had a smallish room facing the street, and then a very large room with a high ceiling in the back. Eddie had suggested it because it would give Martin room to work on large-scale macros. And Martin couldn't help but agree. It didn't take Martin long to pull enough gold from his hat to buy the place outright. After Eddie left, Martin looked at his new home and realized that he had no furniture of any kind. He made a quick list of all the stuff he'd had in his old apartment, then he asked himself how much of it he'd really needed. The answer was, not much of it. He decided that the first things he needed were a table, a chair, a bed, and some bedding. Chairs and tables could be procured here in Camelot, but the comfort level of the standard-issue straw and scratchy blanket bed he'd used at the rotted stump had not impressed him, and he had no intention of spending the rest of his life sleeping in a hammock. In the Banks' living room, chaos reigned. Walter and Margarita Banks could tell from the cacophony of sirens, pounding noises, and yelled threats that their quiet suburban front yard was crawling with law enforcement officers, many of whom would soon be coming in. Their youngest son, Martin, had burst in unannounced and sprinted into his old bedroom, emerging several times in quick succession to model his old Halloween costume, mutter about Draco Malfoy, demand saran wrap, and ask geography questions. Then he demanded a package that he said he'd ordered but seemed surprised to see. Now he was back in his room. The pounding at the door was getting louder. Through the sirens, they could hear a man's voice yelling,
"We are federal agents! We are pursuing a suspect, and we saw him enter these premises! Open the door immediately or we will break it down!
One moment, I'm coming!
Walter yelled. He and his wife Margarita exchanged bewildered looks and Walter started toward the door.
No, Dad, stop!
Margarita and Walter looked down the hall. Martin had come out of his room again. He was standing in the hall wearing a silver sequined bathrobe and a pointy hat. He was carrying a long pole with his old souvenir bust of what Margarita had always called
the stupid wrestler
perched on its tip.
Martin, baby, what's going on?
Margarita asked.
What have you done?
Nothing,
Martin said as he lurched three steps down the hall and threw open the door to the linen closet.
I haven't done anything,
he continued as he grabbed a small stack of sheets and pillowcases.
I especially haven't done any of the things those men are going to tell you I did.
Martin yanked a blanket down from the top shelf, clamped his staff against his body with his left arm, slammed the closet door shut with his foot, and quickly went back to his bedroom, shouting,
Thanks for everything! See you later! Dad, you can open the door now!
The bedroom door slammed shut behind him. Martin rematerialized in his new home, holding a pile of laundry in one hand and his smartphone in the other. He hastily threw the laundry down on the pile of his old street clothes, hoping that would keep them relatively dirt-free. He put down his staff, took a breath, then touched the screen of his phone with his thumb and disappeared again. A moment later, he reappeared, bear-hugging the mattress from his childhood bed, which was rolled up like a giant burrito. It still had all of its bedding attached, as if he had simply pushed the fully made mattress over on itself, stood it on end, threw his arms around it, and hastily teleported out of there, which is exactly what he had done. He let go of the mattress. It unfolded and fell limply to the floor, creating a low whoomp noise and a noticeable cloud of dust. Martin said,
I'm home.
22. 2 days later, Martin's place was coming along nicely. He had a nice flat table to set his laptop on and a chair to sit on as he used it. And use it he had. He'd taken a page from Philip's playbook. He set up exclusionary zones that kept anyone from entering his building if he wasn't there. He poked around the shell and found that most of the food items he'd want to replicate were already programmed in. That saved him some labor and the trouble of getting a stew pot, although he figured he'd have to get one eventually if he was going to have anyone come visit. He had already tweaked his macro to make it less of a showpiece and more of a practical display of power. The people of this chronologically polluted version of medieval England were much more sophisticated than he had originally suspected, but he still doubted they'd be impressed by his ability to do the worm. He was working on this and that when, for the first time on his own, he heard the eerie, warbling chime that meant that the hand phone was ringing. Martin held his hand up in front of his face and said, Hello? A crudely animated image of a flaming skull filled Martin's hand, and Gary's voice filled the air.
Hey, Martin, you're still using the default icon.
Oh, I hadn't even thought about that. What is the default icon?
The words default icon,
said Gary's disembodied voice.
Yeah, Martin said. I gotta fix that. Yeah, well, do it later. I need you to come to my place right now. You know how to get here?
Yeah, don't use any coordinates you give me.
You're smart, Martin. But I promise, no funny business. This is serious. Just use the location code Skull Gullet Cave.
Martin took a moment to make sure he was presentable. He put on his hat, grabbed his staff, and moments later he was standing in the massive stone mouth that marked the entrance to Gary's home. He found Jeff waiting for him.
Come on back,
Jeff said, beckoning Martin deeper into the cave. They passed through the carefully designed set, through the concealed door, and into Gary's comparatively pleasant apartment. Inside, Gary was sitting on a bench next to Gwen, who was gripping a mug with both hands and looking off into the distance. They both had their backs to the table. As Martin and Jeff entered, Gary nodded subtly to them and tilted his head toward the other bench on the far side of the table. Taking his cue from Jeff, Martin nodded back and silently took a seat across the table from Gwen and Gary. After a moment, Gary turned sideways so he could address Jeff and Martin and still observe Gwen, who only moved occasionally to sip from her mug.
She showed up here about a half hour ago, Gary said. She was really worked up about something and wasn't making any sense. She said I was the closest wizard she knew. I hitched her horse and wagon and brought her inside.
When I finally got her calmed down, she told me why she was freaked out, and I got worked up and didn't make any sense for a while. Then I called you two, and now you're up to speed.
Why didn't you call Philip? Jeff asked.
I tried, got no answer. He's probably up in his attic, doing nothing.
Sadly, it went without saying that Gary had tried to reach Tyler and failed.
How'd Gwen know where you live?
Martin asked, and immediately regretted it. Any other time, he'd have been tortured a bit for asking, but Gary wasn't in the torturing mood. Or perhaps, for the first time, he actually was.
I've invited her here more than once, Gary said. You can't blame a guy for trying.
Actually, women can blame a guy for trying,
Gwen said without turning to face any of them.
We do it all the time.
Okay, so come on, what is it? Jeff asked. Gwen, what happened?
There's a farmer who's been complaining that my garments get longer over time.
Oh, yeah, Sam, right? Martin said. Got his whole village convinced. Gwen ended up altering a ton of clothes.
Gwen nodded. She still hadn't turned to face them, instead staring into her drink. Jeff watched the back of her head as she spoke. Martin's eyes drifted to the hood of her favorite cloak, possibly the only one she owned for all he knew. The hood tapered to a point down near the small of her back in a decorative flourish.
It's weird, the things we notice at times like these, Martin thought.
I got all the alterations done, Gwen said, so I loaded the wagon and went to deliver them.
There was a long silence, punctuated by Jeff saying, And?
They were dead.
Martin and Jeff looked at each other, then at Gary, then at the back of Gwen's head. Martin hadn't known that it was possible for the back of someone's head to look upset, but Gwen's did.
Sam and his family?
Martin asked.
Yes,
Gwen said.
And his neighbors, and every other person in his village. Everyone, Martin. Everyone's dead.
Gwen was remembering what she had seen, and was understandably starting to lose it again, so Gary took over.
It's a little village about an hour's ride away, not on any map. It's called Ricard's Bend. I'd say about 100 people, give or take, live there. I don't get it. How does a whole town die? Were they attacked by animals or something?
No,
Gwen said.
Were they attacked by raiders? Martin asked.
Gwen stood and turned to face them. To Martin's surprise, she was not crying. She didn't even look close to tears. She looked close to murder. She said,
I don't know what happened to them, but I came here because I thought you lot might.
A few minutes later, they materialized on a hill on the outskirts of Ricard's Bend. A cluster of 7 or 8 smallish buildings with stone walls and thatched roofs stood on either side of a wide dirt road. The countryside was a random collection of gently rolling hills dotted with farmhouses and grain fields. A smallish river cut through the landscape toward the town, then predictably bent, right about where Martin figured some guy named Ricard had found it. It would have been quite idyllic, if not for all the corpses. At first, Martin didn't see them. It was obvious from a great distance that the town was completely still, which was eerie enough. Then, as they walked closer, they could see what looked like people having naps leaned up against trees, or in front of buildings, or face down in the middle of the road. Once they got within touching distance of the buildings, there was no doubt in any of their minds, or noses, that everyone was dead. Gwen was handling it better than the three wizards. Of course, she'd seen it before. None of them were forensic scientists, so there was little scientific about their actions. They yelled to see if anyone would answer, but they neither expected nor received any reply. Martin strained his ears, but all he heard was the sound of a dog growling somewhere far away. They walked around in a daze, looking at the dead bodies and exchanging confused looks with Gwen. When Gwen wasn't looking, they'd exchange alarmed looks with each other. There was no sign of any violence or bloodshed. It reminded Martin of things he'd read in history class about poison gas attacks. An entire village, caught in the act of living its life, killed in one stroke. There was evidence that it hadn't been an entirely normal day. Upon close inspection, certain patterns emerged. Martin very badly wanted to look at a member of the village he had seen before.
Hey, Gwen, where does that guy Sam live?
Martin asked. Gwen pointed to a farmhouse a mile or so down the road, sitting on the crest of a hill.
That's his house, if you want to go look. He has a wife and two little girls.
Jeff, who happened to be standing closest to Gwen, put a hand on her shoulder. She smiled sadly at him.
Would you like to magic us there?
She asked all three of them at once. No, Martin said.
I think I could use a walk and some fresh air.
Gary quickly said,
Agreed.
Gwen shrugged and started walking down the road towards Sam's house. Jeff gave the other two wizards a knowing look, then kept pace with Gwen and started a conversation that the other two couldn't quite make out. Gary immediately got to business.
Martin, see anything weird about the bodies?
Mm-hmm,
Martin said quietly.
Sam was right. All of their pants are too long. They all seem to have really stubby arms and legs.
Yep, that's not all. Call me crazy, but it looks to me as if most of them died right after removing their shoes.
Gwen and Jeff were well ahead of them now, walking along the side of the road, next to the now vacant buildings. Martin and Gary were following, engrossed in a conversation neither liked.
That's why I want to see Sam,
Martin said.
I've met him. I know how tall he is. Was.
If I didn't know better, and I don't,
Gary said,
I'd say someone was trying to make hobbits.
I agree,
Martin spat.
This is clearly the work of a wizard.
A voice from behind said,
That's what we thought. Now!
A large piece of timber swung out from behind a building and caught Jeff on the back of the head with a loud crack. At the same instant, Martin felt a brutal impact on his left hand that sent his staff flying, and another blow to his head that plunged him into darkness. 23. Martin didn't wake up so much as he gradually became less unconscious. At first he didn't know who he was, where he was, or what he was doing. Then he figured out that he was Martin Banks, he was in medieval England, and that he was struggling at the ropes with which someone had tied him to, respectively, Jeff, Gary, and a tree. It was dusk, and Martin was seated on the ground with his back resting against the tree trunk and his legs stretched out in front of him, bound together with heavy rope at the knees, ankles, and the arches of his feet. Although he could only see their feet in his peripheral vision, he knew Jeff was on one side of him and Gary was on the other, both in the same position. Their arms were all intertwined as if they were out for a grand day in a musical in the 1930s. Martin's hands were bound together by a length of rope that was pulled tight just to the point of causing him constant discomfort. Another thick rope lashed Martin's back to the tree. Another held his neck to the tree. And a final thick and well-used rope was tied tight around his head, holding his mouth open, effectively gagging him.
Whoever has us,
Martin thought.
It's someone who isn't suffering a shortage of rope.
Martin could feel Jeff and Gary struggling just like he was. They were helpless, lashed to a tree beside one of the buildings that used to make up the town of Rickard's Bend. Whoever attacked them was wise to take them by surprise, disarming them of their staffs, and Jeff his wand immediately. Without their staffs, the shell wouldn't recognize them as wizards and allow them to use their powers. On the bright side, no matter how hard his captors tried, unless they put on a very specific robe and hat and knew some Esperanto, they'd never get the staffs to do magic for them, either. Also, the staffs were unbreakable thanks to the shell, so that was something. Martin could feel that his hat was still on his head. Glancing down to his robe's pocket, it looked like his imp box was still there, meaning his smartphone would still be inside. The staffs, and to a lesser extent the wizards themselves, were being guarded by a single person. He appeared to be young, a teenager, Martin figured. The guard was standing with his back to Martin, watching what was going on in the distance, and Martin couldn't blame him. There was a massive bonfire surrounded by young men. There was a sort of band playing something approximating music. One guy was pounding on a crude drum, and another was playing some sort of stringed instrument that was completely drowned out by a huge bruiser blowing with all of his might into some sort of horn. Martin knew instantly that it was Kluge. He sounded awful, but Martin didn't want to be the one to tell him that. Many other young males were gathered around the bonfire. Some were dancing. Some were fighting. It was hard to tell which was which. Martin thought it actually looked like a pretty good party, until two guys hauled the body of a dead villager into view, then chucked it onto the fire.
Martin was relieved to see Gwen sitting on a stump, well away from the fire, but also far away from the wizards. She didn't seem to be tied up, and nobody seemed to be threatening her at the moment. She didn't look happy either, sullenly examining her measuring stick, probably as an excuse to not make eye contact with her captors. Martin had attended many parties and seen many attractive girls do the same thing. Martin took stock of the situation. He, Gary, and Jeff were helpless. Gwen was surrounded and outnumbered. Their captors had demonstrated a willingness to use violence, and he hazily remembered them saying that they blamed wizards for what had happened here. All in all, Martin thought the situation was grim, but not hopeless. If he could get one hand free, he could get to his smartphone, and with one button press, he could escape. Once he was gone, he'd have the time to plan and prepare and come back for the others.
No, actually, if I press that button, I'll be deposited back at my parents' house right as the cops bust in, he realized. I'd probably still be tied up. At least I'd be dressed. That's something, I guess.
Martin made a mental inventory of the smartphone app's other functions and cursed himself for not having reprogrammed it to do any of the new things he'd learned. Still, he could teleport. It wasn't a one-button process, but if he got a few seconds and a free hand, he could put several hundred yards between himself and his captors. That would buy him time to teleport somewhere useful. Then he could come back and rescue the others. First things first, though. He couldn't do anything until he was at least partially untied, and that would mean talking to the guard, gaining his confidence, and conning him into offering some assistance.
Time to turn on the old Martin Banks charm,
Martin thought, and then winced at how bad it sounded, even in his own head. Martin cleared his throat, which, with the rope in his mouth, sounded like he was gagging. Then Martin said,
"Hello,"
which, with the rope in his mouth, also sounded like he was gagging. Then Martin gagged. The guard heard the third gagging noise and jumped. The guard turned, as if he was afraid of what he would see when he looked at the wizards. At first it was hard to see the guard's face because of the lack of ambient light and the bright bonfire silhouetting him. But once his eyes adjusted, Martin was shocked to see that his guard was Donald Melick, the younger, the boy he had recently helped exercise. Donnie cringed. Then he looked back to the bonfire and all of the young men there and cringed again. He backed toward where the wizards were bound to the tree, watching the gang around the fire the whole time. Finally, he crouched next to Martin and quickly turned to face him.
"I'm so sorry about this," he said. "I wanted to tell him that I knew you and that you were all right, but that would have been dumb."
Martin couldn't argue with that.
"One of the guys is from this village. He came out to threaten his family, maybe steal some food. He comes running back to Kluge and says everyone's dead and they all look weird. Well, Kluge says he doesn't believe it and he wants to see it for himself."
Maybe we were wrong about this Kluge person, Martin thought.
"So four or five of us get here, and it's like he said, everyone's dead. Kluge says it's the best thing he's ever seen."
Nope, Martin thought.
"Someone said that it didn't look like there was any fighting, so it must have been magic that killed everyone. And Kluge starts talking about how he's never liked wizards or anybody else, but particularly wizards. He says he won't have anybody going around wiping out towns and not inviting him. He got everyone all worked up. They wanted to go find the first wizard they could and do something awful. Well, I know you and Philip are okay, so I said they'd never work. I told them that wizards are dangerous. It was pretty easy to convince them since we were surrounded by the bodies of folks killed by a wizard. I told them the only way we'd ever get the best of a wizard would be to catch him by surprise. I just about had him convinced to give it up. Then we see you lot appear on that hill over there, and well, you look pretty easy to surprise."
"I bet we did," Martin thought. "They probably had just enough time to hide before we got our bearings. In retrospect, explicitly telling Kluge that my staff made me undefeatable was probably a bad move."
"Once you were knocked out, a couple of the guys wanted to kill you straight away, but Kluge says we should tie you up and let you sit a while."
"He wants us to sit here and worry," Martin thought. "Now I understand this Kluge guy. I know how he thinks."
"He says he wants to give time for your flavors to meld."
Martin made a mental note to stop assuming he understood anybody. Donnie looked furtively over his shoulder at the chaos around the bonfire. Kluge appeared to be playing the drum and the horn at the same time by hitting the drum with the horn. It would have been quite impressive if it hadn't sounded like a small animal being kicked repeatedly. Donnie said,
"The guys tried to use your staffs to make magic, but it didn't work. So now they're just carrying them around, trying to look all fearsome and impressive. Well, that's not working either."
Now that he was looking for them, Martin could see that a couple of the brutes near the bonfire were wielding his staff with its bust of Santo and Gary's with its Kiss action figures. There was one guy with what might have been Jeff's wand, or might have just been a stick. It was hard to tell unless you could get close enough to see the word Wonder Boy carved into its shaft. Donnie took his eyes off of the fire and leaned in closer to Martin.
"Look,"
he said quietly.
"Kluge told me to tell him as soon as you lot woke up. I'm really sorry about all this. I'm going to try and think of a way to get you out of it, but I have a family and Kluge knows where they live. I'm only still hanging around with him, so I can fade away slowly instead of just not showing up one day. You understand, don't you?"
Martin gagged as affirmatively as he could. Donnie looked equal parts pleased and worried. He reluctantly rose to his full height, turned his back to the three helpless wizards, and yelled,
"Oi! Kluge! The evil wizards is awake! Can we kill him now?"
He glanced down at Martin, who was glaring up at him.
"Sorry, I had to make it convincing."
Then he kicked Martin. Kluge couldn't hear anything over the sound of his own demented horn playing, but one of the oafs yelled in his ear and the music stopped abruptly. Kluge approached with the slow, deliberate gait of a man who enjoys the fact that people don't want him to approach them. Somewhere between 15 and 20 more thugs followed behind. Martin assumed that when word got out that Kluge had captured three wizards, like-minded flunkies had started coming out of the woodwork. None of them seemed to have swords or knives, which didn't surprise or comfort Martin. Swords were designed to kill quickly and easily. Kluge seemed like the type who'd rather do it the slow, difficult way, with tools he crafted himself. An old-fashioned purveyor of artisanal pain. A man who takes his time and pays attention to the details. A man who hurts people for the love of the craft. Gwen rose from her seat and had walked half the distance to where Martin sat before one of the thugs thought to grab her arm and force her to walk to where Martin sat. Soon the thugs had crowded around, leaving about a 10-foot clearing around the wizards to form a natural stage for Kluge to do whatever he intended to do. Donnie was still standing nearby. He was trying to act like a proud bird dog that had presented his master with a dead pheasant, but Martin wasn't fooled. The boy wasn't a very good actor, but he was good enough to fool Kluge.
"Well, well, well," Kluge said. "Looks like our guests have finally decided to wake up."
Kluge was alarmingly tall and broad. His scraggly black hair had grown in a bit since the last time Martin was this close to him. He reached into the crowd and snatched Martin's staff from one of the gang. Kluge was wearing a chainmail shirt he'd most likely stolen from someone who had learned that an armored shirt doesn't save you from a punch in the face. Just standing next to him on the street had intimidated Martin. Sitting on the ground, tied helplessly to a tree at his feet, Martin was terrified. Kluge loomed over them like death itself, and he clearly knew it.
"Where's the girlfriend?"
Kluge asked. Gwen was shoved roughly to the front of the crowd. She stumbled, but caught herself before she fell. She didn't look at the wizards. Martin thought she probably didn't want to give Kluge and his buddies the satisfaction, or perhaps she didn't want to give them an idea where to start. Kluge stooped down to one knee, leaning a bit on Martin's staff. Even then, he towered over the wizards.
"Sorry, we had to be rough with you three, but we couldn't have you turning us into toads or nothing. It stands to reason that if you could do any magic all tied up and gagged like that, you would have by now. So that means we've got you. And if you want to go back to your homes and hang upside down like a bat or whatever it is you freaks do, you're gonna have to do what I say. Now, I'm gonna have the runt take one of your gags out, and whichever one of you is lucky enough to get to talk is gonna tell me how to do what was done to the people in this here town. And if you don't, I'm gonna do something pretty bad to this young lady here."
Martin glanced at Gwen. The thug standing behind her was a head taller, and a full Gwen width wider than her on each side. He had the dull eyes and broad smile of a born follower. He was the type of person who mistook being large for being tough for being strong, and being strong for being smart. He saw that Martin was looking their way, so he put a hand on Gwen's shoulder. It was a reassuring gesture, in that it was meant to reassure Martin that he had no qualms about doing any number of things that Gwen would not like. She had pulled up her hood. Only her mouth, set in a grim scowl, was visible. Her hands were slowly working their way up her measuring stick.
Poor thing, Martin thought. She's probably not even aware she's doing it. I've got to think of a way to get her out of this. She was just in the wrong place at the wrong time.
It was a nasty jolt to Martin when he realized that the wrong place was in close proximity to wizards, or, more specifically, him. Kluge looked at the three wizards, deciding whose gag he would remove. He poked whoever was tied on Martin's left with Martin's stolen staff. Martin couldn't turn his head and could only see the man on his left's boots, but was not surprised to hear Gary's voice.
If I were going to pick someone to tell me how to use magic to hurt people, I'd go for the one wearing black too,
he thought. After a deep breath, Gary said,
Let's get something straight. If you hurt the girl, we tell you nothing.
Kluge smiled. He had a few teeth missing, and the condition of the ones he had gave the impression that the missing teeth were the lucky ones.
If we hurt the girl, you tell us nothing. Voluntarily. If we hurt her enough, one of you might crack. If none of you talks, then we move on to you. We hurt you enough, I bet it'll loosen someone's tongue. If not, we move on to the dandy,
Kluge said, then kicked Martin, who was now regretting his shiny silver robe and hat. Kluge looked at Jeff with great relish.
By the time we get around to this one, I'm betting he'll be ready to talk.
He won't talk, Gary said. None of us will, and you'll spend hours torturing us for nothing.
Martin rolled his eyes. He didn't blame Gary. Martin couldn't think of anything better to say, but threatening these guys with the prospect of having to spend a lot of time hurting people was like threatening an avid golfer with hours and hours of playing golf. Kluge kept his eyes on Gary, but tilted his head toward Gwen and the slab of beef with his hand on her shoulder, and said,
Percy, hurt the girl.
Everyone's eyes, Martin's included, turned to Gwen, who was holding her measuring stick tightly with both hands. Because her hood was pulled up, Martin could not see her eyes, but she clearly did not want what was about to happen. The bully behind her grinned like a delighted child as he put his other massive hand on her other shoulder and started to squeeze and twist. There was a sickening dry snap, followed by a ripping noise. Everyone who heard it winced involuntarily. Martin's impulse was to look away, but he couldn't. He was frozen with disbelief at what he was seeing. Gwen had snapped her measuring stick in half, then in one smooth, clearly rehearsed motion, hooked her thumbs into the sleeves of her cloak and pulled them apart, ripping a seam that had held the sleeves tight to her arms. With the seam destroyed, the cuffs widened to a loose flare. When Gwen held the two halves of her measuring stick up in front of her, it was clear to Martin that they were now two magic wands. For the first time, it occurred to Martin that the exaggerated taper of the hood on Gwen's cloak might not be purely decorative. Later, Martin, Jeff, and Gary would discuss Gwen's salutation. The whole idea of a salutation is to make it plain to anyone who sees it that you do have magical powers and that you should not be messed with. They all agreed that Gwen's was probably the best salutation they had ever seen. And what made it so effective was its subtlety. All salutations were triggered by a specific action or phrase. It could be anything. Philip hummed a tune. Martin, in a failed attempt to amuse Philip, yelled the magic words that Apache chief from Super Friends would use to grow huge. Gwen shouted,
No!
Once triggered, a good salutation would demonstrate the wizard's power by doing something that normal people could not do, and which could not be faked. Philip flew. Martin grew into a giant statue. Gwen emitted a single blinding pulse of white light, like a human-sized flash bulb. At that moment, Percy, the thug who was touching her, flew 20 feet back and bounced off of a wall. The salutation itself made no sound. The people watching made plenty of noise on their own. After the initial flash of a salutation was complete, most of them employed some continuing effect to remind onlookers of the wizard's fearsome power. Philip hovered in the air and emitted a blue glow. Martin, now to his embarrassment, had breakdanced. Faint but unmistakable waves of energy were radiating from Gwen with blistering speed. It looked as if anyone who got their hand too close would see the flesh ripped from their skeleton. Her hood had tipped back slightly. Her face was visible. She had murder in her eyes. She aimed the wand in her right hand at Kluge and muttered something under her breath. Kluge immediately shot into the air, shrieking like a little girl and dropping Martin's staff as he went. He hung helplessly in the air above the heads of his awestruck gang. One of the thugs made a half-hearted move toward Martin's staff, which was now lying on the ground. But all it took was Gwen silently pointing her second wand at him, and he sheepishly withdrew back into the group.
"Now," she said quietly, through gritted teeth, "you idiots are going to untie these idiots, or I throw that idiot into the fire."
The bravest of Kluge's gang said,
"Girlie, you can kill Kluge, but you can't kill all of us before we swarm you."
Gwen tried to answer, but couldn't be heard over Kluge, screaming threats and obscenities at his gang. She sighed and with a flick of her wrist caused Kluge to gain altitude. His voice became more distant and more shrill.
"As I was about to say, yes, I can kill all of you where you stand, but I didn't say I was going to kill anyone, not even him. I'm going to throw him on the fire, then get the wizards out of here whether you untie them or not, leaving you all here with an angry burned Kluge looking to take his pain out on someone, and who knows that none of you did anything to save him when you could."
They looked up at Kluge, who was still raining down curses on their heads. Immediately, the mood of the crowd shifted, and it was clear to all that Gwen was going to get her way. Donnie leapt to untie the wizards before anyone told him to. Martin picked up his staff. Jeff and Gary were given their wand and staff back. Gwen maneuvered Kluge so that he was floating over a tall tree. She stowed her second wand in her pocket and put her hand on Jeff's shoulder. He put his hand on Gary's shoulder, and Gary put his hand on Martin's.
"All right," Gwen said. "We're gonna go now. Consider yourselves warned. Next time any of you gives any wizard a hard time, we won't be so gentle."
Martin quickly grabbed Donnie, put him in a headlock, and touched his staff to the young man's temple. Martin yelled,
"Yeah! And to make sure none of you primitive screwheads tries to follow us, we're taking this run hostage, see?"
The crowd of thugs listened to Martin in silence, then turned in unison to see what Gwen would say to that. She shook her head slightly.
"Ah, whatever."
She looked up at the still-screaming Kluge and said,
"Faligis,"
which caused him to fall quickly into and then slowly through the tree, bouncing off the branches as he went. While everyone was watching that, she said,
"Transporti al plumba pregeo,"
and the five of them disappeared. Not far away, the lead-covered chapel that gave the town of Lead Church its name was an island of tradition and tranquility. Its thick walls and solid foundation gave a sense of peace and solace to the faithful who were sitting in the pews, communing with the Almighty. Their faith, like their church, was unchanging and serene. Then four wizards and a hostage materialized in front of the altar and immediately started yelling at each other.
"How long have you been a wizard?"
Martin asked.
"That's a stupid question," Gwen said.
"Yes, it is,"
Gary said to Martin before turning to Gwen and saying,
"Answer the stupid question."
"I started about a week ago," Gwen said, sneering. "I figured if you fools could do it, I might as well give it a shot. By the way, none of you carry a secret wand hidden somewhere in your clothes. Really?"
"I have one," Jeff said. "It's in my pants."
"Don't make the obvious joke,"
the other three said in unison.
"No, really, it's one of those old school collapsible pointers. I just couldn't get to it because he tied us up."
Jeff pointed his wand at Donnie, who asked politely if he could be released from Martin's headlock. Gary asked,
"How'd they know to take our staffs away anyhow? We don't go around just telling people our weakness."
"Where are we?" Martin asked, changing the subject. He'd walked past the church, but had never seen the inside.
We're in the lead church,
Gary said, before asking Gwen,
why on earth did you bring us here?
A voice from the back of the pews bellowed,
I'd like to know that myself!
The authority in the voice made all four of the wizards freeze. It also made Donnie freeze, but he was already in a headlock and was fairly immobile.